did Malcolm X, the great fighter for justice, he became?
And what he realized is that Malcolm, you know, has always been presented as fully formed and angry, as if he sprung out of nowhere. It was as if he was in a vacuum. But the thing is, we don't talk about Malcolm's lineage, his family, where he comes from, where they come from, and how they impacted him. And that's what Dad wanted to talk about, because this is what forms this person who's one of the most interesting figures of American history in the 20th century. And important because every time that these upheavals happen, particularly when it comes to oppression, people turn to Malcolm.
That's Tamara Payne. We spend the hour talking with her about her late father, Les Payne's acclaimed biography of Malcolm X, The Dead Are Arising. It just won the National Book Award. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Books and movies about Malcolm X abound. There's the autobiography of Malcolm X, of course, co-written with Alex Haley. I read it when I was 16, and it had a powerful impact on me. And countless books followed. Denzel Washington played Malcolm X in Spike Lee's movie about him, and there was a PBS documentary, Make It Plain, which I highly recommend, among other films. But Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Les Payne's new biography of Malcolm, The Dead Are Arising, goes where none have gone before. With his daughter Tamara, who was his principal researcher and wrote a terrific introduction to the book, Les Payne delved deeply into Malcolm's background and upbringing. He interviewed his family and many other sources who have never been tapped before. And the depth of research extended to cover the rest of Malcolm's life, even including a meeting Malcolm X had with the Ku Klux Klan. The Dead Are Arising not only gives a wealth of detail, but also historical context to weave a rich tapestry of the life of one of the most important and influential figures in American history. Les Payne died in 2018. His daughter, Tamara Payne, brought his magnum opus to publication. Tamara Payne, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. And let me congratulate you on this podcast. I think it's very important and how you dig deeper into the issues with writers and those who appreciate these books.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Now, your father, Les Payne, was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor at Newsday, which is the newspaper, you know, I live on Long Island here, so it's a very important newspaper here. Tell us a bit about your dad as a journalist. He often told you kids that he couldn't abide the phrase, "We may never know."
For Dad, journalism was really important because it's about reporting facts and reporting stories that were not known. I mean, you're informing your public. And the power of journalism for my father was that giving these facts to people who didn't know them to help them in making, or the audience, the readers, to help them make informed decisions. And so to say that we may never know is counter to that. And what he might also say is lazy. So yeah, it was really important. But I'd like to talk a little bit about how he got into it. He was in Vietnam. Well, first I'll just say quickly, my father was born in 1941 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Jim Crow South, and his family moved up to Hartford, Connecticut when he was 12 years old. So he grew up there and went to college at the University of Connecticut in stores. And then after graduating, he went into the Army and he served there. And he was he worked under General Westmoreland, managed his newspaper, and managing army-based newspapers is not the same as journalism that he practiced at Newsday, but it kind of exposed him, you know, had him writing, dealing with information and speech writing for General Westmoreland. But an experience that he had while there in 1967, he got to take a reporter from the Washington Post, Jesse Lewis, around the base and show him the life of the U.S. troops. And Jesse Lewis is writing a series about what was going on in Vietnam on this base. And one of the stories Jesse Lewis reports that some of the soldiers had, what they had done was emblazoned the Confederate flag on their trucks. And this appeared in the Washington Post, and President Johnson read this story and was angry, not because of the Confederate flag so much, but that this was in the Washington Post and was in an exposure and an embarrassment of the U.S. government. And so he calls up General Westmoreland 3 o'clock in Saigon time in the morning and curses him out and tells him that he has to have them removed. And my father, you know, was excited because the Confederate flag, you know, was an insult to him. It is for Black people. It's an insult to us. And he was excited about that. And what he learned from that is what he says is that the power of revealed facts reported by a free press protected by the Constitution, which is determined to inform the public, is what's important, to give that information to the public to make informed decisions. And then he saw the power of that. And so he became really interested in journalism after that. He landed at Newsday, the daily newspaper in Long Island. Friend of his was working there and had encouraged him to interview there. And he got a job and started working there as a reporter in 1969. And then he just started really learning the craft and applying it. One of his first really important stories he wrote was about migrant workers, this was a phenomenon, right, around the country. And he would always hear from about their lifestyle and what it was like and the importance or non-importance of them through the perspective of the bosses, but not the migrant workers, who are usually Black. And my dad he decided to get that perspective. So he disguised himself and decided to go to work on a migrant camp for a week in 1970 and out in the east end of Long Island, Riverhead. And he was laying pipes in the fields, irrigation pipes in the fields. And he lived there for a week. And he wrote about that experience. And he said, basically, he needed to make sure he made it to payday to write about that experience. And it appeared in Newsday in 1970. But that was one of the first stories that he wrote that really got people referred to that story to the end of his life.
So your father, Les Payne, began the research for this book, The Dead Are Arising, in 1990. What sparked his interest?
Dad always liked to write about let me go back a little bit. He admired Malcolm X. He would write about him. He had a column. He would syndicate a column at that point. He was writing about him a couple of times a year. He admired him. But he had never felt the need to write a book about Malcolm X before that, because he felt that we had everything we needed to know about Malcolm from the autobiography, as well as from Malcolm's speeches. And what happened was he had the experience of the opportunity to meet his brothers. He met one brother through a friend of his. Well, actually, I think he met both of them through his friend, childhood friend Walter Evans, who lived in Detroit. He was a surgeon. He was treating one of the brothers. And my father met him and interviewed him once he found out who he was. And he was fascinated by what he had learned. And then he came back to New York and he met up with a colleague and friend of his named Gil Noble, who hosted a show on WABC TV called Like It Is. And Gil Noble, also familiar with Malcolm's siblings, asked my father, which sibling did you meet? And Dad explained it was Filbert, who was 2 years older than Malcolm. And Gil said that you should meet Wilfred, who's Malcolm's oldest brother, who was 6 years older. And the importance of that is that not only was he 6 years older than Malcolm, but he was also Malcolm's best friend and confidant throughout his life. And Dad went back to Detroit and met Wilfred and interviewed him for another 8 hours and was just really fascinated by what he learned about Malcolm's family life, what he was like as a child, what that life was like, but also what forces were happening around them, what the community was like, what laws they had to deal with that impacted their day-to-day life and how they navigated that. And so my father was like, we don't know this about Malcolm. And what he realized is that Malcolm, you know, has always been presented as fully formed and angry, as if he sprung out of nowhere. And I often say it was as if he was in a vacuum. But the thing is, we don't talk about Malcolm's lineage, his family, where he comes from, where they come from, and how they impacted him. And that's what Dad wanted to talk about, was not only just Malcolm and his family, but the world that they lived in and the world that Malcolm was born into, because this is what impacts and forms this person that who's one of the most interesting figures of American history in the 20th century. And important because every time that these upheavals happen, particularly when it comes to oppression, people turn to Malcolm for the way he analyzed oppression and how to deal with it and what it does to people. And they turned to him over and over again. They were turning to him. They never turned away from him, actually. And he's constantly read and referred to. But in the 90s, there was like this resurgence almost. Like Spike Lee's movie had not come out yet, but people were talking about him. Rappers were rapping about him. We were hearing his speeches, you know, played out on the street. I lived in Harlem at that time. Well, I was beginning to live in Harlem around that time in 91. And, you know, you walk down 125th Street, you hear Malcolm's voice booming from the speakers every day. And you're hearing the rap songs. And then even when before that, I was teaching in English in China for 2 years. And they knew who Malcolm was. And then that was really interesting to find that out, that he was everywhere. So he became important. And then every time we hear about these upheavals, social upheavals that are dealing with oppression like this, young people turn to Malcolm.
Yes, I was a teen when he was assassinated. It had a huge impact on me. He's never lost his draw to me as well. I think, you know, he's one of those people that just his spirit reverberates. And this book, as you say, I found not only were the descriptions, you know, and the details about Malcolm's own intimate life and his family life so fascinating, so illuminating. Also, as you say, the way the book puts it into context, I mean, this is just a really full and deep history of a time, brilliantly written with lessons that are brought forward from the 1920s to today. The book opens with the KKK coming to Malcolm's family's house for his father. And it's told through the memory of his older brother, Wilfred. His mother stood up to them, pregnant with Malcolm. I mean, what an iconic scene. Tell us about that.
What can you say? It's riveting. It was a great way to open up the book because it just places you right smack in the dab of action of Malcolm's. He's not even born yet and his family's dealing with this. This is what America is like. This is the scene that he is. And basically the family at that point, his brother Wilfred was born. He had a sister, Hilda. He had, and Filbert. And then Malcolm was his mother was pregnant with Malcolm. And so it was riveting in the sense that they're living in Omaha, Nebraska. They're part of the members of the UNIA movement, which is the Marcus Garvey organization. His parents, Louise and Earl Sr., met in Montreal, and they were already members of the UNIA and had been going to meetings in different places. But Earl, who was traveling, you know, liked to go up to Canada, and that's where they met. And they were attracted to each other. And also they were brought together through the connection of Marcus Garvey and their belief in his beliefs. And Marcus Garvey was preaching what? Being proud of your Blackness, Black pride, building up your community, living your life and thriving, and how to do that, and creating a community and a safe space for Black people to do that and express that in different ways, because Black people, the world was very hostile towards, in America, was very hostile towards Black people in doing that. So when they settled in Philadelphia and they started their family, and then they moved out to the Midwest because what Earl wanted to do was set up other chapters of the UNIA. So they moved to Omaha and they were organizing families out there. And, you know, and the Klan chapter, who basically we're going to have to say were their white neighbors, you know, did not look on this kindly and were hostile towards this. And when they see Black people, when they see Black people doing this, that is a threat to what they saw as normal, to their place in society. It's counter, and they want Black people to submit, and these Black people are not submitting. And so then they move on them, and this is the threat. So they ride on the house. Earl Little is off organizing in a few towns away, and Louise is there with her children, and she's telling them that they're not, you know, that he's not home, that they're good people, and they're saying, "You're causing trouble. We want you out of town," and they're knocking out windows. And this whole idea that men are doing this, where on a black woman and child and her children, you know, the father is not there. And even if the father was there, I mean, the whole idea that, you know, that this is happening is let's deal with that. And here's the thing: we have not been dealing with those energies and confronting it and understanding and changing that. And so today, you know, this is a direct correlation to where we are today. But going back to that scene, these men, and she's standing up to them, and she will not bow down. She's not bowing down, and she's still going to protect her children, and they ride off. But that is the scene. And why? That's the question that you have to kind of ask when you're reading that. And so that's the opening scene, and it sets up the case, sets the story in motion as to what black people were up against at that time. And also, this is the world Malcolm is coming into, literally.
Right. You know, so often, you know, it's been constructed as an opposition between, let's say, the Booker T. Washington idea of self-reliance and entrepreneurship, contrasted to the ideal of fighting for social justice that Martin Luther King was involved with. Malcolm X really brought those two things together. And that very much goes back to the Garveyite message that his parents brought forth. I mean, they were real activists and organizers in that movement. Talk about that marriage of self-reliance and social justice that Malcolm synthesized.
It's really important. And I think what's important to understand in the 60s, when we're talking about segregation, there's this quote that Martin Luther King says, and Malcolm has said it, and others, many others have also said it. But what it says is that segregation, it imbues the segregator, and in this case, white people and the oppressors, with a false sense of superiority, and it imbues the segregated and black people in this point, or the oppressed, with a false sense of inferiority. So Martin Luther King and the civil rights groups, they were dealing with changing the superstructure of white supremacy and this false sense of superiority. Because before that, when you don't have laws that protect black lives and their rights to live and thrive, there is no recourse when crimes happen against them, like the Klan riding up against the family and burning their house down. They didn't burn the house down in this case, but there was the threat of that. So there is no recourse. And then, so what the civil rights activists were doing is they were trying to change the whole superstructure. And so there's the social justice part of it. But what it wasn't dealing with was what Malcolm was dealing with, this false sense of inferiority that people have internalized and have used to even define themselves, and saying that, you know, who felt that, well, people won't let us because they don't like me, and they won't hire me because I'm black. My blackness prevents me from having these experiences, and therefore it makes me less than, my value is less. And black people have internalized this. And that's what Malcolm and Garveyism, really through Garveyism, is really dealing with, because that's what he grew up with, was like embracing our blackness, embracing our identity, seeing ourselves as beautiful when everybody else is telling you that you're ugly, you're different, you're a monkey, and not believing that. And what I think is so important is the way we see him do it fully formed. When we see in this book, we deal with how Louise, who, when she was raising her children, she's dealing with their schoolwork. She has an education. She speaks French. She sings to her children in French, but she also deals with their homework, and she wants to make sure they understand grammar and how to write. She's looking at their lessons. When Malcolm or his siblings are complaining that their teachers are angry with them for being prideful, saying they're too prideful for being Black in their Blackness. You know, she goes up to the school and talks to these teachers. So this is what imbues Malcolm. This is the background. This is the foundation of where that's coming from, this identity and embracing that Black is who we are, and we should embrace it as we are. There's nothing wrong with that. And even when people are telling you that you're different, that you're ugly, and really trying to make you believe that. And in a lot of cases, believe it, you know, in order to get a job, it's like you have to accept that, some versions of that almost, you know, and that's what has happened. People have kind of over the years have given in on that. And what Malcolm is trying to do is saying, look, you don't have to do that in order to thrive. You don't have to believe that you're less than, because you're not. And so it's really important that, you know, that we do this, because even if you have social justice, but why view yourself as less than, even if you have recourse to fight it?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tamara Payne. She was the principal researcher for her late father, Les Payne's acclaimed biography of Malcolm X. It's called The Dead Are Arising. It just won the National Book Award.
And so what, you know, what Martin Luther King and his groups are saying, I'm not saying they don't have pride in who they are as Black, but they knew it was wrong. They'd hated that lifestyle in the South. And if you look at some of Martin Luther King's writings too, particularly when he goes up north, and he actually is going through Connecticut, and he sees that there's integration, and he hates the idea of going back South where he's from, where his family is, you know, returning back there and having to live that life. It's torture for him. And so he's like, I want to change this. And so he sees another way that this doesn't have to be this way. And so it's that exposure. And he's still, it's still about pride. You know, he still has pride in doing that. But he's really just, he's focusing on changing that superstructure and changing that whole idea and working with white supremacy and changing these people and how they see themselves as being superior. And respecting and appreciating and legalizing these rights for Black people, because we've been here since the beginning. You know, I mean, when we're being brought here as slaves, and that's what I mean by the beginning. I mean, we've been here longer than a lot of these people who, you know, are benefiting from this superstructure of white supremacy.
And that superstructure, the systemic racism, after Malcolm X's father died in a tragic accident, the full force of both, I guess, both gender and racial oppression, the systemic oppression of that, came to bear on his mother and the whole family. Talk a little bit about her struggles to survive and what happened to the family after Earl Little's tragic death.
I mean, it's tragic what happens to the family. And not only does the superstructure basically put a stranglehold on the family and pulling them apart and Louise Little. But I mean, if you think about it, was also during the height of the Depression, because Earl Little was killed in 1931. And so we're in the Depression at this point. Everybody is struggling. And Louise is now a single mother. You know, she's not making the money that Earl was making, but, you know, she's going to struggle. And also Wilfred steps in as the older brother. And this is not unusual, I mean, in families, right, where the older sibling steps in to help out. And especially if the father goes is missing. And then whether the older sibling is a female or male, they step in and they help bring in money to help support the family. And so Wilfred is doing that. And his eldest, you know, the sister is doing that also. But let's also keep in 1931, you know, Malcolm is 6 years old, but as this is happening over the time, this is a lot of pressure. He's going to school. He's had a close relationship with his father. Just this father being missing from this household, that which was run pretty smoothly, you know, as far as the kids having their assignments and taking care of all the chores to make the farm run, and their interactions with their neighbors and how they, and this is in Lansing, and how they sell them vegetables, for example. Earl's disappearance or removal from the scene, it's tragic. And then when you see this, Louise is getting her widow's fund, the insurance monies that Earl Little was paying for insurance policies, one of them doesn't come through, and which is money that they could have used, you know, to make ends meet. And that doesn't come. And he was paying on that. And they said the reason why they didn't come through is because they said that Earl Little's death was ruled a suicide, even though his death certificate does not say that. So they don't give the family the money, and the family is just struggling. It's a huge struggle, and everybody was struggling at that time. But not everybody had the court, in let's say the probate court, who was also trying to make a move and take the land that they were on away from Louise. And it's like this constant, everywhere that they were living, particularly in Michigan, you know, before Earl was killed, they were on land, they had purchased land that in the deed, there was an exclusionary clause that said that Black people could not own the land. And the white neighbors didn't want the Little family on that land. And so they moved to have them evicted. This is the white neighbors. And then burned their house down, burned the family out of their house. You know, this constant pressure. And then later on, when you have the probate court, the judge in that situation, and she's, you know, she's trying to get her widow's fund, and he's trying to get her to sign over the lands to him.
Yeah, it was just really relentless. And in reading it, you just feel you ache.
Yeah, you get exhausted, actually. I remember going through those sections. It was exhausting. And you know, it's that kind of pressure. It's a lot. But that was not unusual, you know, with a lot of Black families. When you have, it's like what you have, we need you to prove that you should have it almost, you know. It's really, it's exhausting when you really kind of look at it.
Yes. So Malcolm, after his father died, Malcolm kind of became a street criminal. He ended up in Boston and eventually went to prison, which in some ways was the best thing that could have happened to the world. But how did your dad see this time in his life when he basically, this was his teenage years?
Yeah, I think it's really important to say that those were his teenage years, because I would say my personal experience and how Malcolm was presented to me, it was almost as if those years when he was hustling in New York and Boston and, you know, and then when he went in jail, that he was like 25 years old. It felt like he was being presented. But he was a teenager. He was 16, 17, 18. And by the time he goes into jail, he's 20. And again, it's like when you're hustling, and you have to think about that time in these cities, what people were doing. In New York in particular, everybody was hustling for jobs, particularly in the Black community. But I'm sure in white communities, there was all kinds of hustling going on. But in the Black community, yeah, this is what was going on. I mean, what jobs could Black people get with their limited access to resources and education? So Malcolm, yeah, he was hustling and he was learning a lot. He was learning a lot about the not just street culture, but people, the psychology of people. It was like Malcolm's curiosity was always, you know, he was always interested in meeting people. And he was a talker. He wasn't shy, you know, and it was just really interesting just watching his whole personality kind of unfold like that. And some of the things that he got into, particularly like when we looked at what happened with Red Fox, who was a comedian later known as Fred Sanford from Sanford and Son and other shows. But really, you know, we know him from the 70s as from Sanford and Son. But he and Malcolm worked in a Jimmy's Chicken Shack in Harlem in the kitchen. And they were dishwashers. And, you know, and Red Fox was his name was John Sanford. And he was also from Chicago. And they called him Chicago Red, and they called Malcolm Detroit Red. But he said that, you know, Malcolm, you know, John Sanford was trying to be a comedian, so he was really more about his art. But he said that Malcolm would take dares, he would take on these different hustles, you know, because everybody was hustling. He said it was interesting watching Malcolm do that. But they were friends, and he made them laugh. It was great, you know, when you kind of listen to that perspective on him. And we talked to other people who knew Malcolm. Vicky Garvin, who met Malcolm in Ghana, she actually worked in Harlem around the time when, she actually did meet him. I think she did meet him, she said earlier on, but she didn't really, you know, spend a lot of time with him, but she had seen him around, and she was just like, yeah, he was a talker. but she also saw him later on when he was preaching. We can get to that later. But there were people, it was just his curiosity and how he would get into, and even when he describes it, those days in his autobiography, it's just really interesting, the details, but also how you could tell he was also studying people and what they were doing and how they, you know, reading each other and how they would interact with each other and what that meant and the different signs and stuff like that. It was really interesting.
Tamara Payne. We'll talk more about her late father, Les Payne's biography of Malcolm X, The Dead Are Arising, after the break.
But don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim. And then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him.
Yes, sir.
This is American justice.
Yes, sir. That's right.
This is American democracy.
Yes, sir.
And those of you who are familiar with it,
yes,
know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
Right.
Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail.
Right.
But if you can't prove that a democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
That was Malcolm X in his 1960 speech on police brutality, Democracy is Hypocrisy. Now let's get back to my conversation with Tamara Payne about The Dead Are Arising. That's the acclaimed new biography of Malcolm X, written by her late father, Les Payne. Tamara Payne was the principal researcher assisting her father, and she wrote the introduction to the book. Before the break, we were talking about Malcolm X's teenage years, when he was a street hustler in Harlem and Boston. And so, well, he does finally get caught, much to his surprise, and goes to jail. It's a shock. And his brother Wilfred, his oldest brother Wilfred, reaches out to him. Wilfred's become involved with the Nation of Islam. Talk about Malcolm's conversion in prison.
Yeah, and I love the story about how Wilfred gets involved. Wilfred joins the Nation of Islam because he's living in Detroit and he's working, he's married, but he also wants to get involved with the community because, you know, that's what he grew up with, right? And he looks at the UNIA organization his father was involved with, and he said they weren't really doing anything, but then he comes across the Nation of Islam. And what he is attracted to is their work in the community and that their philosophy of building their businesses and supporting each other. And when he goes to their meetings, you know, he says, yeah, it resonates with him because it reminded him of what his family did when he was growing up. And it was a return to that. And so he wanted to grow with that. And he got all of his siblings to join. And also being concerned, they'd never forgot about Malcolm, even though he was in jail. They would visit him. Malcolm in the beginning was not, you know, he was not a great person to visit, but he would write to them. They would write to him. So they never forgot about him. And neither did his half sister, Ella, who also lived in Boston, who, you know, would also go in and visit him. But they never forgot about him, and they wanted to bring Malcolm in. And they also felt that this would be great for Malcolm because they also realized that while they're joining the Nation, Malcolm's also studying. He's reading everything. He's writing. He's debating. He's really expanding his mind now and his intellect. So when this comes along and they work on him, you know, because they want to make sure that he sees how he got in trouble too. you know, that he understands, you know, that, and that he shouldn't pivot into that. He should pivot into something else. And they bring him along with that. And it's his family that brings him along. It wasn't, you know, that the Nation of Islam reached out to him in prison so much as really it was more the family did that. And to the extent that Elijah Muhammad even wrote to Malcolm and encouraged him to write, it was through the encouragement and discussions that Wilfred had with Elijah Muhammad. And so it was the family that brought that brings him along. And that's important to understand that Malcolm's family that we don't really hear a lot about is there in the background supporting him, encouraging him, and carrying him along also. For us even, and this is really helpful to us as the in the world and how we benefit from this. But it goes to speak on the importance of family.
Exactly. That is just such a wonderful contribution of this book, The Dead Are Rising, by your father, Les Payne, and you, because you completed the book after his death and did so much on the research, Tamara Payne. So Malcolm becomes, of course, now a very important disciple of Elijah Muhammad. He goes to Hartford, Connecticut, where he establishes a temple and a community there. Your father, Les Payne, was a native of Hartford, Connecticut. And in fact, the title of the book comes out of a speech that Malcolm X gave in Hartford. So talk about what he established there and what that speech was about.
Writing the chapters on Hartford was really exciting for us because Dad was from there. We have family there and Dad knew Hartford. So one thing about writers is that we should write about what we know. And Dad was really excited about writing about Hartford in that sense. And once he found out that Malcolm had organized the temple there and meeting the founding families of the Hartford Temple and realizing even that our families had connections. One of the people who Dad interviewed actually worked in a post office, my uncle, my father's oldest brother. So it was really interesting in getting these stories and then seeing how they parallel Malcolm's stories or his family stories and even our stories, our family stories. So it was exciting for Dad even to write that chapter. And the importance of that chapter, I think, is that Elijah Muhammad, it was known that he had tried to establish a temple in Hartford and people weren't receptive to him, to Elijah Muhammad when he came through there. And let's also keep in mind that Elijah Muhammad is the leader of the Nation of Islam. So Malcolm's, all of his efforts and the things that he does in the Nation of Islam, he always goes to Elijah Muhammad and to get his permission. So when he's invited to Hartford to speak with the people and find out, you know, he starts finds out what their interest is, and they said that they really are serious about this, you know, he has to go to Elijah Muhammad to get permission to say, can we start this temple? And so Elijah Muhammad approved that. And the thing about Hartford, it was kind of off the beaten track. It wasn't in Boston, definitely wasn't in the Midwest, in Detroit or Chicago, which were heavily in dealing with the hierarchy of the leadership of the Nation of Islam. So you kind of get away from that environment and the people who were watching Malcolm and getting jealous, especially because his name is coming, and this is like in late 50s, early 60s, he's in the media all the time. And it's like he is becoming the face of the Nation of Islam as opposed to Elijah Muhammad. So you have other members of the nation who are jealous of this and envious of this, including, you know, Elijah Muhammad's family. So Malcolm in Hartford is kind of organizing. We're seeing him organize independently in a way. And we're seeing how he relates to these people, how he develops their story, you know, listening to their stories, why they came to Hartford. And a lot of the stories are they were in the South somewhere, whether it's Florida or Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia. And there was some issue that usually involved a lynching. And the family either they're trying to get that person out of the South because they were in danger of being lynched, or in the case of Rosalie Glover, who's the woman who invited Malcolm to Hartford, she witnessed a neighbor, a young Black man, basically being lynched. And she just couldn't get over that. And she just said, I don't want to raise my children in this environment. This is too much. And she gathered her kids and moved up north to Hartford. So getting to understand this, this interesting. And then what Malcolm was listening to them and how to process this and how to deal with them. What did this mean? And we get to really see him have these direct conversations with people who are forming this temple and that community. And so it was really important in that sense. And we get a sense of what Malcolm would kind of might have been like once he left the nation and developing his own organizations as he had tried. We didn't get to see him do that in full, but we do get to see glimpses of this while he's doing this in Hartford. Now, the title of the book comes from the Nation of Islam members when they are talking about people who are outside the nation. They are considered dead. And once they join the nation, they are embracing their true selves and they're becoming conscious of who they are as Black people in this country and accepting, you know, Elijah Muhammad's teachings. So when Malcolm writes back to Elijah Muhammad about his working, you know, because at this point he's not just organizing the Hartford Temple, but he's also the minister at the Harlem Temple. He's also dealings with Boston Temple, Philadelphia. He's like the Northeast. This is his region, the Northeast. So he's traveling a lot too, but he's really putting kind of like his stamp on this temple because he kind of was brought in at the ground. He was the first minister to brought in to organize them. He didn't eventually become the minister of Hartford. They placed somebody else there, but he was there in the beginning and setting it up, like how he was dealing with the men and the women, separating them during the meetings, the men living in barracks and teaching them their teachings about not eating pork and stop smoking and drinking and gambling and so on and so forth. You know, he's really doing this in his own style and how he would do it. And when he writes back to Elijah Muhammad to talk about his progress and how his work is progressing in Hartford, you know, he says it's tough and there are obstacles, but we are making progress. And he says in one line in the letter to Elijah Muhammad that the dead there are rising. And that is where the title of the book comes from.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Tamara Payne. She was the principal researcher for her late father Les Payne's acclaimed biography of Malcolm X, The Dead Are Arising. Now, Malcolm's relationship with Elijah Muhammad, as you've already referred to, was not always so comfortable, even from the early years, and it eroded over time. But you also write about, in this book, you and your father, Les Payne, write about the influence of the FBI. So talk about them and talk about, you know, the role that they might have played in fomenting some of the tension within the Nation of Islam.
Well, that was one of the tactics that, you know, Hoover had developed for dealing with these organizations that he felt were a threat to the stability of America as he had seen it. And not only did he infiltrate the Nation of Islam, he infiltrated Martin Luther King's groups and other civil rights groups, but also he had infiltrated the Klan. And this is seen in when Malcolm meets with the Klan in Atlanta. There is an informant in there in that meeting who reports back to the FBI, but he's infiltrated the Klan. And that was really interesting and to talk about as far as the different positions of where, you know, the Nation of Islam and the civil rights groups, as well as the Klan. The Klan wanted to, in the South, they want to uphold, obviously, white supremacy. And they felt that Martin Luther King and the civil rights group they were succeeding and they were threatened by that. And so they wanted to find a way to blunt that. And they thought they could develop an alliance with the Nation of Islam who weren't interested in integration. They wanted separation. And the Klan was like, fine. You don't want separation, you want to stay away, but maybe we can align ourselves and go up against Martin Luther King. That was what the Klan's approach was about with the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam, under Elijah Muhammad's direction, was about finding what deals that they could make, because Elijah Muhammad was interested in setting up a separate state in the South. So it was really interesting how that played out. But when you come back up north to the Nation of Islam and also with, you know, the civil rights groups, Hoover felt that this was, you know, a threat to the American society's stability. So what he wanted to do is to destabilize these groups. And he did that through, not just misinformation, that stories that were planted in newspapers, but he also had developed informants, and he also had surveillance. He had surveillance on Elijah Muhammad. He had surveillance on Malcolm. And Elijah Muhammad's homes were tapped with the electronic taps, and they were just collecting information, you know, what their movements were going to be. And at some point, you know, they got hip to it, and they would try to work around that, you know, whispering meetings, or figure out where the taps were and not be in that place, or not speak loud about things, and definitely not speak about information on the telephone. But what this does then is also it creates this atmosphere of paranoia, because you don't know who to trust. Because it's not just that you have these electronic surveillance, but then you also have people who are joining the nation. You don't necessarily know who they are, what their interests are, what their agendas are. And so there develops this paranoia and mistrust of people. And that destabilizes the group. And it also destabilizes, you know, further Malcolm's relationship with Elijah Muhammad.
And you mentioned that meeting the Ku Klux Klan. I can imagine my listeners going, wait, what? Tell us about this. This was a meeting in 1961 in Atlanta. A telegram appears at the temple down there. Malcolm is down there giving a speech. Give us a sense of how this unfolded and what was at stake.
Yeah, so Malcolm is speaking, and he's not the minister of this temple. This is the Atlanta Temple in Georgia. The minister at that time is Minister Jeremiah X, later known as Jeremiah Shabazz. And Malcolm is speaking, and the telegram arrives. And, you know, when they take that telegram, they read it, and they're trying to figure out what this is about. And the telegram's from the Klan. They say, you know, there's something we may have to talk about. Let's have a meeting. And so the protocol was to go back to Elijah Muhammad and figure out what they want to do. What's the response going to be? And they do that. And Elijah Muhammad, you know, he's thinking about this because he has a southern strategy that he wants to, you know, continue to build businesses, but he also wants to buy land. He wants to set up this separate state. The Nation of Islam does not want to integrate with white society. They want to have a separate state, and they want to be left alone. They want to have their own laws and set up their own protocols. And we know what we've already kind of talked about, the civil rights groups and Martin Luther King were doing, is that they were about desegregating the South and protecting voters' rights, you know, for Black people, among other things, just protecting the Black people's civil rights. And the Klan, they want segregation. They want white supremacy. So they feel immediately threatened by Martin Luther King and the civil rights groups and all those who joined their forces. So they wanted to get rid of their enemy. So when Jeremiah and Malcolm go up to discuss this with Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm's view is that, hey, this is a great opportunity to have like a face-off and a confrontation. And already, you know, Elijah Muhammad has already had letter exchanges in their newspaper, Muhammad Speaks in the Philadelphia Inquirer, I think it appears, where he's going back and forth with J.B. Stoner. And Malcolm wants to have a further confrontation and a face-off because he doesn't want to have any kind of alliance with the Klan. This is an unholy alliance in his view. And let's keep in mind that the Klan has not been a positive force in his life. They appear when he's in utero with his mother, standing her ground. They are also a force in Lansing, in Michigan. And supposedly we're spreading rumors that they had killed Earl Little, because there's a whispering campaign about that in Lansing also. So Malcolm, he doesn't want anything to do with the Klan and develop any kind of alliance. And when Elijah Muhammad puts this out there, that what he wants to do is let's have a discussion. Malcolm is turned off by that. But he also wants to be there at the meeting. He wants to impact, because he definitely doesn't want them to go with hat in hand only, you know, asking for favors. You know, he wants to have something to do with the presentation of all of this. And so that's why he wants to be part of the meeting. They have their meeting. I'm going to let your readers read it in the book, because it is fascinating how it unfolds, and getting the details of that meeting is great. And to have that, because what you see is the culture and the language and the discussion of that time of these different groups of particularly the Nation of Islam and Malcolm and Jeremiah, as well as the Klan. And it's really important to see that. And it unfolds, but Malcolm, as I said, he doesn't agree with this. And this is what kind of begins the rift between him and Elijah Muhammad. He realizes that he doesn't agree with this, and Elijah does, and that starts that fissure, you know, between them.
And we should say J.B. Stoner was the head of the Klan at that time?
Yeah.
So fast forward to February 1965, a day that will live in infamy, the assassination of Malcolm. You and your father had some remarkable sources, an undercover New York City policeman who cast a whole different light on who was responsible for the murder. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
What was really interesting about the assassination, I mean, it's a horrible thing to have gone down. And let's just say that. And that to have it gone down so publicly in front of his family, it's just horrible. Let alone this is somebody who's taken away from us that was really important to America, society, and younger people that are coming up and reading him. And to have him taken out like that, it's just horrible. But as far as the assassination, yes, there were informants in the room. A New York City policeman, well, he was a New York City policeman, but he was an informant. He was hired as an informant by the New York City Police, BSI, Bureau of Special Services and Investigations. And they gave him the assignment to infiltrate Malcolm's groups. And he got in there and he worked on security detail. And the thing about Gene Roberts is that he came out of the military and went straight into BSI. And with military training, he worked as a medic, but he also worked with security clearances too. So it makes you wonder even more about, it's not just simply that it's the New York police. It makes you wonder what other forces are also being involved with this too. Not simply because, you know, Gene Roberts, but because we found out that there are other FBI informants who are on the scene. So now we have two different agencies, and there probably are even more that we don't fully. So I won't say that we fully nail it, okay? But I think that we need to understand what's important to know is that Malcolm was a marked man. It wasn't simply that he was marked by the Nation of Islam, but that these government agencies also had a hand in this, wanting to see this go down and also fomenting the environment in which this could go down. Through informants, through infiltrators who are being provocative in the Nation, as well as in Malcolm's groups. And Malcolm's groups being, he was forming two groups at the end of his life. One was the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and the other was the Organization for Afro-American Unity. And that was modeled after the Organization for Afro-Unity, which was in Africa. And he had spent the last year traveling, 10 months of the last year, traveling throughout the world, meaning Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, and just learning more about what was going on in the world firsthand, and making his Hajj after splitting from the Nation. And so he was expanding his worldview too. And to have him taken at that point as he's evolving and learning about this and expanding, it's just really sad. But I think I would like to say, leave your audience with on the assassinations, that the work that went into particularly those last chapters was a lot, and it's important, and it's best done if you read it. To just talk about it, to me, just doesn't really do it. It's a disservice. I mean, you really should read it. It's brilliantly put together.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this book, you know, this is almost 700 spellbinding pages. We're just skimming the surface here. You know, you made reference in the beginning to Black Lives Matter. I'd just like to ask you, what do you think Malcolm would have made of the Black Lives Matter movement and this moment in American history where the support for it has been so wide? I mean, yes, there's been a backlash, but there's been huge multiracial support for Black Lives Matter. What would he make of that?
Malcolm would be really proud to see people, not just on racial, but just oppression, right? Because people all around the world are also speaking up about oppression and particularly racial oppression and class oppression in their countries. through Black Lives Matter. So it's not just what's happening with us here in America. And Malcolm would be really proud to see that. But particularly here in America, I mean, Malcolm would be very involved with the young people and helping them organize and understand and be able to synthesize how to be more effective in attacking. Not just, it's important to protest. It definitely is important to get your voices heard, but it's also important to really hold the system accountable for what it's doing and to put that pressure in an effective way to enforce changes. And he would have, you know, been very creative, I believe, in helping us. And with the advent, I mean, of the internet, it'd be really, I mean, he would be, you know, so far, I mean, he was ahead of his time back then, you know, he would be able to put a lot of that. And the other thing with him being ahead of his time, that helps us to be able to attack this the way we are and being effective. And I also would like to make the point of that, because some people say, wow, if Malcolm had the internet, but Malcolm, when he was alive, he had the television. And the way he mastered television to his advantage, to using sound bites and looking in the camera a certain way and really making people uncomfortable, speaking directly to people, the way he communicated was really something to see and experience. And we need to keep that in mind, because that has also influenced a lot of young people who came after him, from Muhammad Ali to Farrakhan, to a lot of these rappers, to a lot of our entertainers, but also a lot of our politicians, including Barack Obama, just in how to communicate even. So it's important to see that and to recognize that, but also to continue that tradition and find new ways that are current and effective in our society today through the internet and other organizations to hold these systems accountable for what they're doing.
Absolutely. And Tamara Payne, this book, The Dead Are Rising, that you and your father wrote and you collaborated with him on, has been such an amazing contribution to that struggle, to that fight. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Francesca, thank you for inviting me and having the opportunity to discuss this.
Tamara Payne. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Tamara Payne's introduction to The Dead Are Arising. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.